This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Again, that's Winter Folk, Saturday, February 2nd at the Aladdin Theater in Portland, a benefit for Sisters of the Road. More information can be found at kboo.fm/winterfolk2013.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at our carbon-neutral Echo Brew Pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia, information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com.
Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. In the book that I'm going to be talking about today with the author, there's a quote from a physicist, Albert Bartlett, that the greatest failing of the human race is our inability to understand the exponential function. My guest today is Rob Dietz, and he has a background in economics and environmental sustainability, and he's dedicated to revamping our economy to fit within biophysical limits. With Dan O'Neill, Rob has co-authored Enough is Enough, Building a Sustainable Economy in a World of Finite Resources. And I'd like to read a quote that Noam Chomsky had to say about this book. This lucid, informed, and highly constructive book shows that with the will to act, solutions can be found to build a steady-state economy geared to meeting human needs. So, Rob, you're here on the phone from Corvallis, right?
That's right, Stephanie. Thanks for having me on the program.
I think it's great that I have you.
Yeah, well, thanks for that introduction. That was really nice.
Good. And I'd like to just start. There is something in the book that you talked about, storage units. And basically, this is like something that tells us a lot about ourselves. And I was wondering if you could just start with, what does this tell us about ourselves?
Well, the part in the book where I talked about that, I was really trying to get at the unsustainable level of throughput that is running through the economy. And by that, I mean the amount of materials and energy that we're consuming. And, you know, if you look at the word economy, its root comes from the Greek word meaning household. So I thought it would be interesting to take it down to the household level. And within our own houses, we can much more easily track how much energy we're using, how much we're consuming as compared to an entire economy. So it makes a fairly good metaphor. And I got into looking at the self-storage industry because it's been this incredibly fast-growing, the fastest-growing industry in real estate in the United States. And I think it's telling us something that, you know, we are bringing so much, so many material goods into our households that they can't even hold it anymore. And
right.
The same thing is really happening in the broader economy.
Right. Just this concept of more and more and more, as Albert Bartlett said, just exponential forever.
Yeah.
And yet economists and politicians and the media, they're almost universal in extolling the virtues of growth, you know, and an ever-rising gross domestic product, GDP. And I just briefly, what kind of future are we looking at if we just continue to live this way?
I think it's a future of collapse. Unfortunately, we're faced with these profound problems, both environmental and social. You know, if you're like me, you've gotten kind of scared about where things are going,
yes.
Especially with climate change and with biodiversity loss, with worldwide poverty issues. I mean, we have some serious, serious problems, and the status quo, business as usual way that we approach the economy isn't going to cut it. The solutions are not to be found by doing what we've been doing. So that's really what the book is about. What could we do differently? How could we build an economy that works for us, for people, and for the planet?
Yeah, and that's actually what I want to get into. And I'd like to let listeners know, if you want to call in and talk with Rob too, the phone number here at KBOO is 503-231-8187. Rob Dietz, the book is Enough is Enough. And so basically you're part of something called CASE, the Center for the Advancement of a Steady State Economy. You write something called the Daily News, which is about all these issues. And you're really entrenched with this. It's great. And I just to begin that part of it. So if we were able to, you know, nobody believes, I think, or not nobody, but very few of us believe that we could move to a steady state economy. But I'd like you to just give us a sense of what that would be like if we could. I mean, what would it be like to live in an economy that wasn't growing? Because that's basically what you're advocating, right?
Yes, it is. Sure, I'll give that a shot. I guess the first thing to do is to help people understand what a steady state economy is.
Right.
And it's not a failed growth economy. I mean, the reason economists fear the end of growth is that the way things are structured right now, bad things tend to happen. You know, people lose their jobs. You know, financial systems collapse, but that's because the whole set of economic institutions is set up for growth. So what we need to do is reform those institutions so that they can function well in a more stable economy. So at its base, a steady state economy means that we would have a stable number of people who consume a stable amount of energy and materials, all within ecological bounds. And the idea is that the goal of increasing consumption gets replaced with the goal of improving quality of life. You know, it comes down to this basic choice. Are we aiming for more stuff or better lives?
Right. And the idea that, you know, the fears of stagnation and poverty and things like that, like your book really goes through like how these can be eliminated, and it was fascinating. But one of the first things you talked about, not the totally first, was how the population would have to be stabilized, and actually that might even have to go through a period of degrowth. And that's really critical to this, right?
Yeah, I mean, the amount that we consume collectively, it depends on how many of us there are and how much each of us is consuming. So there are two pieces of the equation, and if we're going to, you know, the planet really only cares about how much stuff we're taking, right? It doesn't matter. You know, you can have a lot of people consuming very little, or you can have fewer people consuming more per person. And so the idea is to get to a sustainable level, to have, you know, that stable number of people with a relatively stable amount of consumption and within the limits of our ecosystem capacity.
Right, and going from 7 billion to 9 billion is not that direction. And how would businesses change their priorities exactly?
Well, you know, businesses right now are beholden solely to profit. You know, we've set up a system where profit is what matters, and where shareholders, their incentives are tied to that company's growth. So there's this built-in growth imperative that is running pretty wild throughout the business community. And so there are a lot of different ways that we could set up business. We talk a lot about different structures to create value, like co-ops, various kinds of social enterprises. So you're looking at kind of more of a purpose-driven enterprise. You know, and many businesses, of course, are purpose-driven, but if they're beholden to profit and that's the overriding function, you know, the overriding thing that they're trying to achieve, then we often end up with these results that we don't want.
Yeah, maximizing, optimizing productivity. We have a caller on the phone. John?
Yeah. Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I guess the best question would be, how are we going to overcome the domination of the major media that tells us so many lies? For instance, I heard the interview on Positively Revolting with the guy who founded Food Not Bombs, and he basically said all over the country they're shutting down Food Not Bombs, and people don't even realize this kind of totalitarianism is going on around them.
That was
right under their noses.
That was definitely one of my questions at some point, is the media, the politicians, that sort of thing. How would you address all that, Rob?
Yeah, it's a tough question. We actually devoted a chapter to trying to end the silence among politicians and the media. You know, nobody is willing to pick up the topic of the limits to growth. You know, even Obama in his inaugural speech talked about getting tough on trying to fix climate, but, you know, and at the same time, he'll talk about needing to grow the economy, and the two goals aren't really compatible. So, yeah, we need to and work towards that, and how we would do that.
Hey, Rob, your phone kind of cut out a little. Could you repeat that?
Oh, sorry about that.
Yeah.
What I said was, you know, in Obama's inaugural address, he said we need to combat climate change, and you know, he was talking pretty tough on that front. But at the same time, he would also say we've got to grow the economy, and the
right.
two goals are not compatible. So, you know, we've got to get politicians and the media talking about this in realistic, honest ways. And one of the things that my co-author Dan and I concluded is that this isn't going to happen from above, right? I mean, a lot of the people that are running media, that are in charge of the messaging, they benefit from the economic growth society, you know, and the costs of that, they largely aren't the ones bearing those. So the idea is that we've kind of got to build it up from the ground up. We've got to demand it. So students need to demand that that the courses and the research that's done in their universities is, you know, that the econ departments change. We've got to start coming up with new forums to engage people to push politicians and to get the media silence ended. So, you know, I think it's the movements that we've seen over the past few years in follow-up to the financial collapse give me some hope that we can really make some strides that way.
Yeah. I want to let listeners know I'm talking with Rob Dietz. He's co-author with Dan O'Neill of a book called Enough is Enough, Building a Sustainable Economy in a World of Finite Resources. And again, this book was full of actual real solutions. I mean, things that we could actually begin to do and things that to really change how we are living on this planet. And definitely the idea that we have to like change our approach to everything, it would change what we care about, it seems like. And changing our attitude toward money, changing our attitude toward what matters. And I'd like to get maybe back a little bit to like money itself. What is wrong with the way that we're using money right now?
Well, most money, you know, when we think of how money comes into existence, we often think of government printing presses. But the reality is that almost all of the money that circulates in the economy is in the form of debt. And this debt is created by banks out of thin air. You know, it's not based any longer on how much money they've got on hand in their vaults. It's, you know, if I go into the bank and I ask for a loan and they grant it to me, they just put that money in my account and they created it out of thin air. Well,
no reserves for it, in other words.
Right, no reserves. And so I have to go out into the economy and generate enough money to pay back the loan plus interest. So given that all of that money is debt, and that everybody who's out there in the economy working has to, in the future, pay back more, there's obviously a growth imperative built in to money. And so one of the main ways to combat that is to change banking such that we no longer grant the power of money creation to private banks and to create money out of thin air. And so that would require that we raise the reserve requirements. You know, it's almost nothing now.
And you had actually raising the reserve requirements to 100%.
Yeah, over time. I mean, you wouldn't do it overnight.
Right.
The kinds of changes that we are advocating, as you've already said, Stephanie, are sweeping. And, it's not going to be an overnight flip. But raising the reserve requirement to 100%, giving public banking authority the ability to create and spend money into existence debt-free. And that, you're right, that's a complete change from how things are working.
Right. It almost struck me as like a utopian kind of image that you're creating for us. But and it would change a lot in terms of just how we are. Like, one of the things I thought was really interesting was how people who live in cultures, it would also create a lot more equality in the society, the kinds of things you were talking about in your book. But actually, people, even the richest people, you were saying, live longer and are happier when they do these kind of surveys. And could you talk about that? Like, how does that work?
Yeah. So a lot of our discussion of equality came from the work of Kate Pickett and Richard Wilkinson and their outstanding book, The Spirit Level. And over years of data collection, what they found is that when you reduce the gap between the very rich and the very poor in your society, we could be talking across nations, we could be talking across the states of the U.S., what you find when you reduce that gap is that society is better off on all kinds of indicators of health and well-being. And so it would do us all an awful lot of good if we could reduce inequality. And the U.S. has gotten to be the leader in inequality. We have the biggest gap between our rich and our poor, and it's hurting us. It's hurting our health. It's hurting our longevity. It's making us less happy. It's increasing violence and crime in our society. And so, a big part of the transition to a steady state economy is making sure that that we have more equality of income and wealth and more equality of opportunities.
And you talked about that the way we would measure progress would be, instead of the GDP, there's like the genuine progress indicator or the happiness, Happy Planet Index. Could you just briefly talk about those?
Yeah, I love these. In fact, that's my favorite kind of starting point, because if we measure what we care about and we report that widely, then we'll be working towards actually improving what we're doing, actually achieving progress, rather than trying to achieve more money changing hands. And that's what GDP is about. It's about the final value of the goods and services we produce over the course of a year. So it's about how much money is changing hands in the economy. But these other measures, they tell us something more. So the genuine progress indicator, it takes the standard GDP calculations, but then it subtracts out all of our negative expenditures, our remedial expenditures on things like dealing with crime or medical bills, or things that aren't really good for us, but that we pay
paying for our problems.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
and then it adds in the things that don't get counted up in market transactions, but that are clearly valuable things we do for society, like raising children or caring, volunteering to care for the elderly or something like that. And when you take a look at the genuine progress indicator over time compared to GDP, it's a pretty striking picture emerges. The GDP is on this upward track, pretty steadily rising, and GPI, the progress indicator, has flatlined. And that tells us that a lot of our economic growth has actually been for these defensive expenditures, and that's not really where we want to be.
Things that are not making us happy. Again, the phone number here at KBOO is 503-231-8187 if you want to call in with some questions for Rob Dietz, author of Enough is Enough. And basically then, it seems as if, as we were talking about earlier, that we have to change our priorities. And these kinds of shifts, you're saying, maybe could take place in academia, but maybe the whole Occupy movement was like sort of in that direction. Do you see that kind of thing actually starting to happen, or snowballing at all, or just sort of a little trickle of it? What kind of changes are you thinking that you're seeing?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would classify it as snowballing at this point, but I certainly am seeing a little broader awareness. With what's happening environmentally and socially, a lot of people are questioning the system right now. But the idea of a steady state economy just hasn't had the backing. It's not something that's in the mainstream media, and it's not something that a lot of people understand. And that was really one of the main reasons the book. We wanted to have a readable, engaging description that would help people understand what the vision is for this economy that meets our needs without undermining the life support systems of the planet. I think that there is some recognition out there, growing recognition, that we need to change what we're doing, that maybe infinite growth on a finite planet isn't the best idea, but I don't see right now, it certainly isn't in the mainstream media.
We have another caller.
Okay.
Sean, what was your question?
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
I've been hearing talk about the GPI, it seems like for 20 years now, I was wondering if you'd address the problem of countervailing forces or achieving a kind of revolutionary leverage. I mean, it's one thing to talk about, how GNP is a ridiculous indicator and so on and so forth. In other words, we all know what we should be doing, and yet we have no leverage, we have no countervailing force to capitalism, and the only thing it seems that has ever provided that is a kind of vanguard party that's willing to be violent. So I was wondering if you'd address that problem of not having any leverage, not having a countervailing force to implement these excellent ideas.
Thanks. In other words, unseating the entrenched elites.
Yeah. Well, I think there's one advantage that we have, a nonviolent approach, which is to a large extent we can withdraw from the systems that we feel aren't working for us. If you want to play a role in avoiding climate change, you can withdraw from the fossil fuel economy as much as you can. If we want to change the way banking works, we can change what we're doing with our money and with our investments. If you want to withdraw from consumer culture, there are ways to do that, especially, in a place like Portland, where there's a lot of people thinking about the sharing economy, the gift economy, and the barter economy, and there's a lot of local businesses that are thriving. So I'd recommend that as much as we can, we take that sort of nonviolent approach. I also think that a lot more needs to be done in raising our voices. You said, Sean, that the idea of the genuine progress indicator and that sort of thing has been around. And I agree, it has been. And it seems like every so often, a few pundits here and there bring it up. Maybe a state even takes it somewhere. But it's not as if we have this groundswell that says, look, our current measures aren't working and we don't want them anymore. We want this. And so we need to, I think, figure out how to unify our voices into a much stronger countervailing forces.
Yeah, maybe something with the social networking, or I don't know either. It's just to make it bigger.
Yeah.
And you yourself are working for an agency called the Center for Advancement of Steady State Economy. Could you just say a couple of things about that really quickly?
Yeah. I used to actually be the executive director of it, and I resigned to write the book, but I am still the editor of the Daily News, which is named after Herman Daly, D-A-L-Y, who is the economist that inspired a lot of what Enough is Enough is about. And so the center itself, the idea is that we need to make this transition to a steady state economy, and so it's all about trying to educate the public on what that is and how it works. And I'd encourage folks to check out the Daily News. We put an essay up each week from economists and activists, and that try to get at some of these, try to explain some of the problems and get at some of the solutions.
Yeah, actually, I went on your site and signed a petition there. So there's a lot of things to do on that site, and you hold talks and you're writing position papers. You're trying to, and it seems there that there are more and more economists kind of joining you, sort of environmental economists, basically, right? People who understand the environment and the economy.
Yeah, there's it's probably been about 20 years now since the International Society for Ecological Economics got started. And there's kind of this weird thing. You have this discipline called ecological economics, and it's not very widespread in our university systems. There's a few, like the University of Vermont has a good program. There's certain professors scattered here and there, but it's clearly in this sort of fringe sub-discipline area. You know, if I go into a university to take economics, which I did, I majored in economics when I was in college, there was no ecological economics. And what needs to happen is that ecological economics needs to become economics. So the more we can support that, the more that students become aware of it and demand it.
And the more it gets out there. Yeah, well, we're beginning to run out of time. Your website is www.steadystate.org, right?
Yep, that's right.
Yeah. Well, I really encourage people to check out that website. It's really fascinating, and there's a whole world of stuff going on there. Is there any just one last second that you like to say something? 10 seconds.
Yeah. Well, I would just say that the key to getting things going is we need widespread awareness.
Widespread awareness.
That we need enough in our economy.
Right. Well, this is a beginning, maybe, or an addition to the awareness starting to get out there. And I just want to thank you, Rob, for being on the show. You've been listening to Rob Dietz, co-author with Dan O'Neill of Enough is Enough, Building a Sustainable Economy in a World of Finite Resources. Both Rob and Dan are on the staff at the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy, and Rob, who I've been speaking with too by phone from Corvallis, Oregon, edits the Daily News. Learn more at steadystate.org. This is The Recovery Zone, a show about healing our world on KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and thanks to Kurt Lauer for his engineering and Kevin McLeod for our music, and thank you for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 11:29. Coming up next, Robin Ryan speaks with David Delk of Move to Amend.
When the desert sun goes down.
Hi, this is Retta Christie, host of the Noontime Jamboree, and I want to invite you to a live music benefit for KBOO, Once in a Blue Moon, featuring eclectic mix of music performed by KBOO DJs. Included are Henry and Moggy from Swingin' Country, the True Vine Ramblers, Bluegrass from the True Vine, Don McLaren and his fiddlin' friends from Swingin' Country, and me, Retta Christie, playing swing music with my one-night stand band. There will also be delicious desserts and coffee, raffles and silent auction. Support KBOO Saturday, February 23rd at St. David of Wales Episcopal Church, 7 to 10 p.m. Tickets are available through Brown Paper Tickets. You can also find it at kboo.fm/BooMoon2013.
I watch that desert sun go down.
This is Robin Ryan for the Radio Zine. This week marks the third anniversary of the Supreme Court ruling known as Citizens United. In this program, I discuss the history and the impact of this decision with two local activists, David Delk and Paul Cienfuegos. I also speak with Andrea Tosi of Repeace for an international perspective. But first, we're going to hear Representative Jim McGovern of Massachusetts at the podium to request a hearing with the Judiciary Committee to overturn Citizens United.
Mr. Speaker, 3 years have passed since the Supreme Court's dreadful Citizens United decision, and we have seen a dramatic increase in the amount of corporate money flowing into our elections, drowning out the voices of ordinary American citizens eager to participate in the political process. Citizens United also epitomizes the so-called, which some now say, the corporations are people. The fact is, corporations are not people, and the Constitution was never intended to give corporations the same rights as the American people. Corporations don't breathe, they don't have kids, and they don't die in wars. My constituents continue to express concern about the growing influence of corporations in our political discourse. They're also demanding action on campaign finance reform because they are repulsed by the large amount of money in our campaigns. And quite frankly, they want elected officials to spend more time on policy, deliberating and debating on issues, and less time dialing for dollars. Unfortunately, the Republican leadership in the House has failed to address these pressing issues during the past 2 years. They have been indifferent. We haven't had the opportunity to vote on any legislation to curb the influence of unlimited and sometimes secret corporate money flowing into our elections. We haven't even had the opportunity to address these issues in committee hearings or markups. Recently, I joined 18 of my